Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Litigation Practice Group, was recorded on May 17, 2012, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on the Texas Loser Pays Law. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we have a special guest moderator, Judge Dennis Jacobs of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit. Judge Jacobs has served as that court's chief since 2006 and has been on the court since 1992. More importantly for our purposes today, perhaps, Judge Jacobs has served frequently as a moderator for Federalist Society programming. Judge Jacobs, the floor is yours.
Well, good morning. Litigation in this country thrives. But the history of litigation reform has been checkered and discouraging, at least to reformers. Alaska is the one jurisdiction in the United States which has an honest-to-goodness English rule, but there's uncertainty as to how efficient it's been or whether it has done very much. The Texas initiative that we'll be talking about this morning, the Texas Loser Pay Rules rule, I'm going to attempt to describe it. It's very complex, but I'm going to attempt to describe it in a couple of sentences. One provision says that if a motion is granted under the Texas civil practice rule that allows dismissal of cases having no basis in law or fact, the court shall order the payment of reasonable and necessary attorney's fees and costs. But that provision does not apply to suits against the government or government actors. The other provision is an amendment to an existing rule. There already was a rule providing that fees may be awarded against any party that rejected an offer of settlement unless the plaintiff recovered at least 80% of the defendant's offer or the defendant ended up paying less than 120% of the plaintiff's offer. But the rule has been amended. There was a 50% cap on the fees, and the cap has been removed, and 100% can now be recovered, at least up to 80% of whatever it is the plaintiff has recovered. These are complex rules, and I don't know going in how effective it is or how they work, but that's why we have authorities here with academic and courthouse experience as to how this works, how it's likely to work, and possible prescriptions for improvement. What we're going to do in one packed hour is ask each panelist to tackle the subject matter for 5 to 8 minutes from that panelist's point of view. Then we'll have some reactions, challenges, and responses among them. And that'll be followed, as is traditional with Federalist Society events, with questions from the audience out there. The order will be Ely Parsley, Walter Olson, and Ronan Avron. And I will introduce each of them before each of them speaks. We're going to start with Mr. Parsley. He is a civil appellate lawyer currently practicing in Austin. He has taught as an adjunct professor at the University of Texas Law School, and he worked as the first rules staff attorney for the Supreme Court of Texas. Mr. Parsley co-authored 11 chapters of the Texas Litigation Guide, the best-known legal treatise covering Texas civil law. He's also one of 9 people who are members of the Texas Board of Law Examiners, which, among other duties, writes the examination lawyers must take to receive their law licenses in Texas. And he has represented Texans for lawsuit reform in legislative matters. Mr. Parsley.
Thank you, Judge Jacobs, and thanks to the Federalist Society for allowing me to be on the call today. I'm going to start with my comments being mostly, I think, descriptive of the legislative process, which I have participated in as an outside advocate on these statutes. So to try to describe, and I think in the description of how we got from point A to point B, give you some idea about the issues that arise in a loser pays sort of context and bill drafting and why it is it ended where it did ultimately. Let me start by saying that Texas law does not allow, and I think it's not unique in this respect, recovery of attorney's fees in tort actions. So most tort actions in Texas, particularly personal injury and wrongful death actions, the plaintiff lawyer is paid on a contingent fee. So as the defendants going into the conversation about the loser pays bill and the original draft of it were really more resistant than one would actually think, because they were concerned that this bill potentially creates an avenue for plaintiffs in tort actions to recover attorney's fees from the defendants that does not currently exist in Texas law. And that was a fairly concerning for them, because for many defendants, they look at it that the plaintiff may not have substantial assets to pay attorney fees. The defendant probably has not been sued unless the defendant has assets to pay a judgment and potentially attorney fees. And so opening up a new avenue to pay now a judgment and attorney fees on top of that that does not currently exist in Texas law was bothersome to the defendants, the companies, the businesses, the individuals who are typically defendants in litigation. So the loser pay law as drafted in Texas and initially filed, and it was House Bill 274 in the 2011 legislative session, created a defendant trigger. That is, there were no fee-shifting provisions unless a defendant declared that the defendant would like to have fee-shifting in the particular case. And that was intended, as I said, to address this idea that a defendant did not want to be subject to attorney's fees that it never before had been paid under Texas law and that suddenly would become due under a pure, straight-up loser-pay system. Once triggered under the draft bill that was filed, either side could recover attorney's fees from the other side. So the defendant exposed itself to paying attorney's fees. But the bill went further to say that a contingent fee was not regarded as an attorney fee that could be paid under this bill. So that actually gave the defendants a second layer of protection, but as everyone might see, was pretty controversial, because now that basically said that most tort litigation in Texas, which is done on a contingent fee, the plaintiff could not recover attorney's fees from the defendant, but the defendant could recover attorney's fees from the plaintiff under the bill as it was filed. And that was pretty highly controversial, and as you all can imagine, was regarded as somewhat an unfairness in the bill as originally filed. The bill also said that the trial court, as a matter of law, would determine the prevailing party, whether the plaintiff or defendant prevailed and therefore was entitled to recover of fees. And based on that provision and sort of other things that were in the bill, defendants were concerned that there would be more new trials granted than currently is the case in Texas if the defendant won. So the defendants were worried that they would be, even if they invoked the statute and they were entitled to recover attorney fees, that a trial judge in many parts of Texas would say, this doesn't seem right, Mr. Defendant, and you can either waive your entitlement to attorney fees under this statute, or I'm going to grant a new trial, which in Texas practice is pretty freely granted. We have for years had a practice that a new trial could be granted for any reason at all. Recent Texas Supreme Court authority has limited that a little, but still new trials are pretty freely granted in Texas. So all of that, describing all of that, is the reason that there was some fair amount of resistance from the defense side about this bill. They thought that it might not be useful, it might not be worth invoking it very often, and even if they did invoke it, they might not actually, as a practical matter, ever actually recover attorney's fees, and it was opening up a new source of plaintiff attorney fees being collected from them, at least in theory. The second that, because plaintiffs typically don't have money, the second thing the bill did was allow the defendants to collect directly from the plaintiff's attorney if the plaintiff's attorney had a contingent fee interest in the case. And again, that was highly unpopular, highly controversial, because the plaintiff bar argued philosophically, we're not a party to this case, and now we're having to pay potentially damages, even though we've not been sued and are not a party, and that's philosophically not how litigation is conducted. All of those led to a shift in this bill as it was going through the process to where it became an amendment to the offer of settlement practice that Judge Jacobs referenced, and it took out a cap that was currently in that statute that existed since 2003. That statute had a cap on what could be recovered from a plaintiff by a defendant of 50% of economic damages. It took that cap out where you could recover 100% of economic damages, and it created a motion to dismiss practice, which we've never had in Texas, and a requirement that fees be shifted to the prevailing party if a motion to dismiss was granted. So I think I'm sort of at the end of my time, but that's where we went. And I guess my point overall is that the drafting for loser pays and the implementation of loser pays is more complicated than we realize and is more controversial for the defense side of the bar than many people realize when going into the process. It just turns out that the devil truly is in the details. So, Judge Jacobs, with that, I think I'll pass and then be available for further comments and questions later.
Thank you very much, sir. Our next speaker is Walter Olson. He has been a senior fellow of the Manhattan Institute. He is now a senior fellow at the Cato Institute's Center for Constitutional Studies. He is author of several highly influential books, including The Litigation Explosion, The Excuse Factory, and most recently, Schools from This Rule, Legal Academia, and an Overlawyered America. He writes articles for The Wall Street Journal, The New York Times, The New York Post, and is most prominently the founder of Overlawyered.com, one of the most popular law blogs. Mr. Olson.
Thank you, Judge Jacobs. I will start out with a few words on the overall rationale for loser pays, talk about some of the issues that every loser pays system has to face and that they do face overseas when they implement it, talk a bit about where we are in America, where we have adopted a few bits and scraps of the idea, but they've been very resistant to the whole package, and then talk a little about why we have been so resistant. I've been involved in writing in favor of loser pays for more than 20 years. I was on the scene when the Contract with America promised to enact loser pays and did a terribly botched job of that. But let's just say that it has not spread as rapidly as I had hoped, and I'll try to wrap up by explaining some of the reasons why, which I very much agree with what Lee Parsley was saying. First, on the overall rationale, it's considered pretty clear by people in most countries other than the U.S. It improves the degree of justice in a case if someone who turns out to have been in the right is compensated for the cost of having to prove that. That is an injury that is done sometimes to an innocent defendant, which should be compensated other times to a plaintiff with a good case who should not have to walk away with recovery that is often severely reduced by the cost of pressing the case. And beyond justice, it provides better incentives. If you worry about people being too litigious, overusing the system, using the system tactically, this is a way for society to put a price tag on it, saying, watch what you do because you may have to pay for your damage. It is interesting when you begin looking at the individual systems that prevail in most other countries because they are all a little bit different from each other. It is very much a matter of historical organic development. And each of the systems considers, and each of them provides often rather different answers to a series of three questions. First is, who has prevailed? The people who come to the issue fresh think, well, of course, the person who wins has prevailed. Lawyers know it's not that simple. You have been arguing about eight issues. The plaintiff wins on a couple of them. The defendant wins on a couple of them. There's a split decision on a few of them. And the two broad branches of determining who prevails are, you can compare it with the party's positions in settlement negotiations. variations, or you can examine what they spent their time arguing about. Some cases you spend nearly all the time arguing about the damages rather than the liability. Other times it's mostly the liability rather than the damages, and so forth. And so every system has to hinge the fee shift on more or less fine-grained determination of who actually got closer to their way. And in many systems, fees are in fact split. If both sides prevailed on some of the issues they were arguing about, then fees will effectively fly in both directions, and some sort of netting out will be done. The second question is, what is the quantum of fees to be shifted? And of course, Texas examined that question as well. It gets complicated, but I will just say, summing up the practice in every other country I know of is that no one tries to allocate 100% or more of fees. They all undercompensate, and I think the reason is because in hundreds, indeed thousands sometimes, of years of experience, it has been found to create new problems to overcompensate or to award effectively punitive fee shifts. So everyone shifts, perhaps it's 20%, perhaps it's 50 or 75%, but they don't shift all the fees that the prevailing party actually had to pay. And the third question is how and by whom it's determined. And again, this is coming up in the Texas case. There's a division of practice. Many countries entrust the decision to the judge who handled the litigation as a whole, and that judge, of course, is the most familiar with who misbehaved and who was arguing a weak case. Other countries turn it over to so-called taxing masters, special magistrates, and the rationale there is that because this is kind of boring and tedious and sometimes wrapped up in personal resentment, at least it frees the judge to move on to another case in chief while the lesser magistrate determines the taxing. So where are we in America? Judge Jacobs mentioned that Alaska is the only state that has loser pays. It has had it since it was a territory. But we do have bits and pieces. In particular, we recognize sanctions-oriented fee shifting in which someone has violated Rule 11 or in some other way done something extremely unmeritorious. And the diligent lobbying of our organized bar has ensured that that sanctions-oriented fee shifting is very limited and very hard to get and very exceptional. We, in addition, especially since the 70s, have had one-way fee shifting, and this is the very curious American exception to American exceptionalism, which is that if you're in the environmental or civil rights or various other areas, not only is there fee shifting, but it's often very generously calculated multipliers and more than 100% of fees, with the proviso that only plaintiffs get the benefit from it. And this, if you explain this to people from other countries, and they will often roll their eyes, because the initial justice rationale is being made as asymmetrical, and the law is effectively winking and saying, well, we actually want one side to have an edge in the litigation, so we're going to tilt the playing field in their favor. Nonetheless, it provides an interesting body of experience. Anyone who says that loser pays is too scary because people wouldn't bring decent cases to court has to grapple with the fact we do, in fact, use it in lots of cases, and it does indeed scare defendants out of pressing valid defenses. Finally, we have quite a bit on the state level. We have quite a bit of offer of settlement-driven loser pays. I believe there are statutes that get used fairly often in such big states as California and Michigan. You've got a bit of two-way fee shifting on some areas of discovery motions and various other things. So there is some headway being made for it, but not as much as you would think, given the popularity of the idea elsewhere, given the popularity of the idea when people are polled in America. And I'll just very briefly wrap up by talking about some of the obstacles. One obstacle familiar to all lawyers is the vertical and horizontal dividedness of American justice. We have forum shopping between federal and state courts. We have forum shopping between different state courts. And if one big state jumped in with genuine, strong loser pays, it would soon find that a lot of litigants were forum shopping cases to or from federal court in order to get or avoid that state's loser pays, and also that a lot of cases were being forum shopped between states in order to get or avoid that state's loser pays. And that has been one disincentive to getting any state tried other than Alaska, which is so odd as a state and so on, you know, much at a distance from the rest of the American litigation culture. Secondly, Loser Pays is very organic, and Lee Parsley was mentioning that it gets complicated once you realize how many different moving parts have to move at the same time. And when people have tried to move forward anyway, they've gotten disasters like the Florida experiment and medical malpractice fee shifting. Everyone agrees that it failed terribly. We can have an argument as to why, and there are different law review articles, but it was basically dropped at sloppily and without foreseeing how people would use it. And it was so disastrous that the doctors themselves lobbied for its removal a few years later. And finally, Loser Pays does not have a big constituency among business defendants. I've talked with many of them. I've pointed out to no avail whatsoever that their divisions in Canada and all around the rest of the world happily live under Loser Pays and have what they regard as much more rational litigation dockets over the same sorts of controversies. But they say, no, you know, it is bound to be interpreted against us. We don't trust the courts to not turn it into just another way make us pay money, and we'd rather the devil we know than the devil we don't know. That's where we stand. I think we may someday have to work around or even against the business lobby if we're ever to get to effective Loser Pays. Next.
Thank you. Our third speaker is Ronan Avraham, who is a Thomas Shelton Maxey Professor at University of Texas School of Law. His areas of expertise include medical malpractice, torts, tort reform, law and economics, and insurance law. Professor Avraham has law degrees from the University of Michigan at Ann Arbor and from Bar-Ilan University. Prior to teaching in Texas, Professor Avraham served as an associate professor of law at Northwestern University from 2003 to 2007 and was a visiting professor at Tel Aviv and Bar-Ilan universities. He created and published the database of state tort law reform, currently in its fourth edition. His primary research interests recently are economic analysis of torts and healthcare law. One assumes he has been quite busy. Professor Avraham.
Thank you, Judge Jacobs, and thank you, the Federalist Society, for inviting me for this podcast. What I would like to do is maybe give a very short survey about what we at the academia know about loser pays rules. As was mentioned before, most Western legal systems have what we call the English rule or fee-shifting rule, where a party who prevails in litigation is generally entitled to indemnification from the losing party for his or her costs of prosecuting the lawsuit. But in the U.S., since I think exactly 1800, that was eliminated, and we have what is called the American rule, where each party bears his or her own litigation costs. What I would like to point out is what we know about the incentives. We think that the American rule versus the English rule provide parties with. The conventional wisdom, I think, is that the English rule will discourage frivolous lawsuits, and that is partially correct, and I want to show where it is correct and where it is incorrect, and then maybe at the end of my talk, I will suggest other ways to combat frivolous lawsuits. So where is it true that the English rule, that is the fee-shifting rule, the rule we don't have here in the U.S., combat frivolous lawsuits? The English rule discouraged filings by low probability of prevailing plaintiffs with large claims. Why? Because they have low probability of prevailing, and therefore they're likely to lose, and if they lose, they'll have to pay their cost under the English rule. And therefore they will be discouraged from doing it relative to the American rule, where they will not have to pay the other party's legal costs. So this is well known. What I think is less well known is that at the other extreme, the English rule encourages filings by high probability of prevailing plaintiffs, but with low claims. So those plaintiffs, until now, under the American rule, would not have filed their claims because their claims might be small relative to the cost of litigating this claim. So if you think about a small or medium injury in medical malpractice, litigating medical malpractice is very expensive. And if you have a small or medium injury under the American rule, it's not worth litigating it because everything will be eaten by the litigation cost. But if you shift to the English rule and your legal costs are paid by the defendant, then those claims could be filed. So the English rule, therefore, does two things. One is to discourage low probability large claims, but on the other hand, to encourage high probability low claims. And therefore, from a social welfare perspective, at least in theory, it should be. It looks like a desirable result. We wanna, as a society, discourage the long shot, and we wanna encourage those that are likely to win, but the only reason they don't win is because they have relatively small claims. So, from a social welfare perspective, the English rule seems desirable. From defendants' perspective, above and beyond the reasons that were mentioned by the two speakers before me. Just for the reason I just mentioned, it's not clear whether or not they're better off having fewer low probability large claims but higher high probability low claims. It's not clear at all. Another set of incentives that I think it's important to realize is that once claims are filed under the English rule, we should see an arms race. And the intuition is that the English rule creates more scope for disagreement between the two parties. Now they're not only disagreeing about the award claimed, but also about the litigation costs. So instead of fighting about $100, they're fighting about $120 or $130. And because more is at stake, their incentives to invest to win the case are such that they will, in fact, spend more money on litigation that will increase litigation costs and increase the length of the litigation process. So the fear, the concern is that it creates arms race once cases are filed. So beforehand I spoke about the incentives to file cases, and now I'm focusing on what happens to the incentives after a case was filed, and the fear is that it creates an arms race. So in sum, it's not clear really which rule is better. We saw that on the incentive to file a case, the English rule may have a desirable result because it encourages high probability claims. Those are the strong claims. But on the other hand, it creates an arms race. For defendants, too, it's not clear whether they're going to make them better off or worse off. And we saw from Mr. Parsley's description that during the legislative process in Texas, defendants had some serious concerns about that. There are some empirical studies that check, what is the impact of the English rule versus the American rule. And basically what we know is that when parties can choose, because sometimes you can opt in or opt out of these rules, when parties can choose which rule they want to be subject to, the American rule is preferred about as often as the English rule. In practice, from what we know in other countries is that, as I said before, most countries have the English rule, the loser pays rule. What we know there is that it's not applied much. That is, parties, not as often as you would think, go after the other party's litigation costs for reasons that were mentioned before me. But if at all, it applied in an asymmetric way. That is, when plaintiffs win, often they go and collect their costs from defendants, but when defendants win, they're less likely, sometimes even never, go after plaintiffs for their defendants' litigation costs because plaintiffs often have just no assets, and that's a concern that was mentioned in Texas. We have to remember one more component, which usually is not mentioned in those debates, and that is the availability of insurance. We have to remember that defendants have liability insurance, which covers also their litigation costs. So really, the impact on them is only indirectly through higher or lower premium, but their litigation costs are covered. And then in countries that have the loser pays rule, for example, in England, a market for what's called after-the-event insurance for plaintiffs has emerged. So plaintiffs, when they file a lawsuit, they can, and in fact they often do, purchase insurance for the exact case that they lose the claim and they have to pay defendant's litigation costs. Well, we can buy insurance for this. So what I'm trying to say is that a lot of the things that we think will happen, that there will be maybe more deterrence or less deterrence, really through insurance on both sides, both the plaintiff side and the defendant side, those things are smooth and the impact is much smaller than we might think. So I think I'm out of my time, and I return the microphone to Judge Jacobs.
Thank you very much. At this time, is there a desire for an interchange among the panelists? I mean, some rather provocative things have been said. Does anyone wish to respond to anyone else?
This is Lee Parsley. I don't have a response so much as a question for Professor Avram. The market in England for insurance, did it just sort of develop on its own? Was there legislative activity that created that market, or how did the English come to insure for the possibility of a loss by a plaintiff in litigation?
What I'm sure is that it has developed by itself. I have a vague memory that this is something that has been going on for a long time. I want to say centuries, but I'm not sure. Well, we have insurance only from the 19th century, but I think it has been going on for a long time because they have the tradition of the fee-shifting rule from at least the 13th century. So that is just given there. It's part of the culture. And I think that they had after the event insurance for a very long time, and it's not legislative action. It's just the markets have.
Yeah. If I could jump in, this is Walter Olson, because
please.
The English insurance market, and this probably also applies to many other countries, developed so-called legal expenses insurance, which is distinct from after-the-event insurance, but it's typically a component of homeowners insurance, and people have been buying it and companies have been supplying it for a good long time. The idea is that just as the insurance company will defend you against other risks, so it will defend you against the risk of having to be a plaintiff in litigation. And as I understand it, it is a relatively inexpensive coverage to get, which therefore many British homeowners go ahead and get. The reason it's inexpensive to provide is that if the insurance company is correctly calculating the cases to proceed on your behalf for, it's getting the winners, and so there is a fee shift coming from the defendants potentially. And this ties in with one of the points about both kinds of insurance, which is that, and also on the defense side, which is that although it does provide staying power to both plaintiffs and defendants, there is an insurance company bureaucrat in there calculating the risk of loss and potentially saying, well, no, this is a long shot claim. We are not going to put our companies, as assets at risk for something with only a 20% chance of prevailing. And so you wind up with some of the societally desired discouragement of long shot cases. A Canadian lawyer said that costs have a calming influence, and it's this pervasive thing where whoever might be left with the bag and who may not have the grudge that is impelling or be caught up in it personally the way the litigants are is just given a reason to say, please go slow. This is not as likely a winner as you may think.
I agree. That's a good point, and I guess we cannot talk about it right now, but I just want to flag that it ties into another issue which I'm sure the audience is interested in, and that is a recent phenomenon in the U.S., but not so recent in the rest of the world, and that is of third-party litigation funding.
Yeah.
And I think the argument you made equally applies to the system where a third-party funder can tell the plaintiff, I'm not going to help you in this case because you have a weak case. You better just drop it, or at least I'm not going to help you. So the same effect applies there, but that's a different issue, although they are related conceptually.
Third-party funding is taking flight here in the United States. There are some very substantial financial institutions that are busy with it. I have an increase. Do we have questions lined up?
We don't, but we can open the floor to questions at this point if we want to do that.
Why don't we open the floor to questions? Questions, of course, are sentences that start with who, what, where, you know, and the nature of them is to elicit information you don't already know. Until we have a backlog of them, however, I have an inquiry that I'd like to present, and that is, how can this ever possibly work when judges will always be reluctant at the end of a case to start a whole new inquiry into who was justified in this and who succeeded in that, and of course, successful lawyers are going to be reluctant to have their adversaries delving into their billing practices. It would seem that this is just an initiative with no future.
Judge, before we get to that, this is Dean Reuter. Let me actually open the floor to questions.
Okay.
So stand by just a second. So if anyone has a question for our experts, you would push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. And, Judge, you can have your question answered, or it looks like we have at least one question in the audience.
Why don't we take I'd like to elicit a response to mine first, because mine sort of wonders whether this has any future at all.
I want to amplify the question. I think other people here might be in a better position to answer it, but I just want to point some irony, and that is, if there's a trial going on and who prevailed and how much of the fees should be recovered, etc., the Luther Pays rule would apply to this trial as well, and that can go on forever. So I just want to amplify the question and let other people answer it.
Yeah, and every so often in Luther Pays systems, there will be a further fee shift for having unreasonably contested legitimate fees or unreasonably requested more than legitimate fees. On the judge's question, I think you have to balance, as far as inconvenience to the lawyers, the likelihood that the process in the main litigation might be a little more rational, just because what's known as the lifted eyebrow sanction, which the judge says, are you really making that motion or are you really resisting that motion, is now backed by an actual meter running in the judge's mind. You know, not only am I raising my eyebrow, but I'm going to remember this when it comes time to determining how many fees get shifted. And I favor in Loser Pays making it explicit that, you know, you're not just doing one big determination of who overall won, but you are empowering the judge to punish everyone who wasted the time of the other people in court. And I think that even though it's a cost to have the additional round of litigation, it is potentially a benefit for all concerned to empower the judge that way.
Let's go to the first question from the audience.
I invite the participants to focus more on the particular reform here in Texas, which I think has some peculiar problems that discussion of the English system doesn't really address. I've observed too many trials in which the judge abused his discretion to impose sanctions on litigants or arguments that he just didn't like. And I see this as creating too much additional discretion for abuse on the part of the judge. Now, we have a traditional solution to frivolous litigation, which is a counterclaim for abuse of process during the trial or for malicious prosecution afterwards, which can be decided like the main complaint by a jury, who may provide a more neutral decision on the matter than the judge would. And I'm also concerned that this tends to discourage litigation that is the most common kind for ordinary middle-class people, which is just above the level of small claims, but not much above. So that the amounts involved, if there are amounts at all, are small, and in fact they may not be seeking money so much as injunction, or simply to bring out through a discovery process some public problem. such as abuse of authority by local public officials.
Well, let's break that down a bit, because it's really a couple of questions, but I think it's a useful a refocus on the particular Texas statute. And the first part of your question is, doesn't this impose yet more power, confer yet more power on judges? And the suggestion that that a raised eyebrow may cost people money would seem to certainly reinforce the questioner's concern on that score. If we could have responses from the panelists.
Judge, this is Lee Parsley.
Yes.
Let me answer it, I think, partly this way. What I and my practice and my work on these issues around the legislature for now a decade have found is that the public perception is, and the lawyer's perception is, that the old traditional remedy of malicious prosecution, for example, or abuse of process, has two problems. One, in all states, really, it is a very difficult cause of action to prove. And secondly, then it is more litigation, which is not a universal view that we have plenty of litigation, but it's a pretty strong view out there that there is already plenty of litigation. So solving a litigation problem with another lawsuit, it doesn't strike people, at least in the context that I work, as a very good solution, and it's not very useful, it is proven over time. Then you go to this, so what happened over the years, I think, historically, is because that process was not very useful, then the federal courts and Texas courts and other courts around the country, states, have gone to sanctions, give the judge some discretion to sanction a party who has abused the process. And I think the result of that sort of experiment, if we want to call it that, has been that the sanctions process is sort of reluctantly used, if at all, by judges, because judges don't tend to like to sanction lawyers, and particularly in a state like Texas, where the lawyers play such a role in electing the judges. So the sanctions process has not proven to be very effective, which brings us around to where I think Mr. Olson is, and that, you know, what we have and what we have tried so far has not been very effective, and so we need to take the next step, potentially, which is to go to what everyone refers to as a loser-pay system, or the English system for cost-shifting, that is done inside the present case in some mechanism, and that takes some of the discretion away from the judge and just makes it more automatic. And so I think that at least gets us to the present of why it is loser-pays is, I think, strongly supported among the public, is because partly it's, I think, confusion, but partly the public is informed and they think that there's too much litigation and the present process for discouraging that is not functioning. So that's at least my kind of view of why we have loser pays really as a topic at all, is because, you know, the process right now is not doing what arguably it should do. And that might draw some fire from people, I would hope, or think.
This is Walter Olson. I just have one or two points to add to that, which is, as Lee Parsley and Judge Jacobs reminded us at the beginning, the Texas loser pay, as they call it, as it actually enacted, was quite small and really confined to two areas. One, in the case of successful motions to dismiss, which required there really not be any merit at all. That's not going to apply in most cases. It's not going to be much of a fear for most people who have a losing but not blatantly, grossly losing case. And secondly, in cases of offers of settlement, which especially the questioner had interesting a sample case of someone with a dispute somewhat bigger than small claims, or perhaps an injunction case, hard to see where that's going to be a major worry. And indeed, it is with the medium-sized or smallish cases, too big to go to small claims court, that I think genuine loser pays has its most shining moment, because I've spoken with Europeans who say that this is where the American system falls down so badly for plaintiffs. It's these you know, as Professor Abraham mentioned, the small medical malpractice cases, you know that it's valid, you know, everyone agrees that it's valid and it's just not worth suing over, to the point where I've, again, this is what Europeans tell me, they're, Europeans in the insurance business perceive one difference between across the Atlantic as being that loser pays means that it is relatively dangerous if you're a European insurance company to run as a business plan resisting a lot of legitimate claims by your policyholders, and yet there are, not to mention any, but there are American insurance companies that succeed in that business plan because loser pays renders their policyholders so powerless to get real justice from them in many smaller cases.
Okay. Thank you. Is there another question?
We don't have a question just yet.
Well, following up on the question asked by the last questioner, which is to see if we could focus more on the Texas statute specifically, I'm sort of wondering whether this 80%, 20% feature isn't really cutting it so close that that nobody can figure out the calculus. I mean, what's pain and suffering, future medical costs, lost business, damage to reputation? Doesn't that really render the thing essentially useless?
Judge, this is Lee Parsley. That statute, just so that we're caught up and everyone is on the same basis,
yes.
It was passed in 2003, and it does have the 80-20 provision in it, as you've described. So it's been on the books now for 8 years, and candidly, we can't find that there's that much use of it. And I think it is in part because of just what you're saying, that it's a little dense in terms of how it's supposed to function. And if you just read the statute, it's not incredibly clear about that. And then there are, you know, multiple defendant cases make it even more complicated. And so you add all that uncertainty in with a defendant trigger in that statute as well. In other words, it only functions if the defendant says, I would like to invoke this offer of settlement practice. Defendants just are reticent to do it in actual practice, which leads back, I think, to your comment earlier, you know, will this any of this ever work? Will any of this ever actually, is it applicable? And I think there's this real question about that. Is there any way to make these concepts work practically? And I don't know the answer to that. I know that Texas is experimenting, but I don't know that we've found the answer yet with what we've done.
This is Walter Olson. If I could just jump in, although I am by no means wedded to the 80-20 as a threshold, I can see a case for doing it quite differently than that. Lawyers settling cases are always guessing about if it has actually reached the point of being presented to a jury. They are throwing dice often with very wide variances indeed. And so being a litigator who negotiates over the settlement cases, that, you know, the skill set is kind of already in there. I wish it were easier, and yet providing triggers of that sort may encourage people to converge on good, accurate settlement offers rather than just throwing out something wild and hoping that it misses by a mile.
Well, the concept is certainly as you describe it. The idea is to encourage, frankly, defendants to make an early and offer that ought to be a good one. In other words, to ever get the fee shifting to work, you need to make an offer that's good enough that gets within that 80-20 rule, that's better than 80% of the judgment the plaintiff ultimately gets, or else you can never get fee shifting. So the idea of the statute is to encourage settlement and to encourage early settlements by, you know, make a good offer early on, and then if the plaintiff doesn't accept it and should have, then the plaintiff will have to pay the defendant's fees, and vice versa. If the plaintiff makes a good early offer that the defendant should take and doesn't, then there should be fee shifting in that circumstance also. But in practicality, it just has not flourished in Texas so far. And so that means there's something that we have not done in terms of creating the incentives for use that we need to do. And right now, I'm not sure that anyone knows exactly what that answer is. There's still some time yet now that the statute was amended with the new offer of settlement sort of provisions that makes it more useful, people hope, in the last session. So the loser pays kind of concept that was incorporated a little bit into the offer of settlement statute in 2011 maybe will encourage more use of it. Time is not told yet on that, but it may be still that we don't quite have the formula that encourages the settlement offers and that awards attorney's fees when people aren't cooperative in the settlement process, which is what the statute's really designed to do.
Okay. Is there a question on cue?
We do have another question lined up here, Judge.
Let's take it then.
In fact, this is Ronan Abraham. I was disconnected, so I called again as a listener. So I would like to comment on the offer of judgment rule. New Jersey has had it from 1990, and from the limited empirical data that we have, the only thing that has been able to be shown is that the time to settlements, and therefore also litigation costs, but the time to settlements decreases. But we have to remember that it's very hard to gauge an impact of these rules because already 90 plus percent of the case law settles. So it's going to be, and this rule attempts to encourage more settlements. It's going to be very hard to see a shift from 92 to 93, et cetera. It's going to be very hard to find an effect. What I do like, though, about the law in Texas is the other part, is the motion to dismiss. And I think Mr. Parsley talked about the dilemma between giving judges more discretion versus something which is automatic but might end up being totally not fair. And I think that the compromise or the rule in Texas is a nice compromise because it attaches the loser pays to a motion to dismiss, a successful motion to dismiss. And there the judge presumably makes a decision not based on questions of fee shifting. It makes the decision based on the facts and law. And so there's on the one hand discretion that this case has no merit in fact or law, and then we have an automatic fee shifting attachment. So it's hard for me to see why people will object, any people, even people that object to fee shifting, why they would object to fee shifting in cases of successful motion to dismiss.
Oh, I have a question, and that is, wouldn't that provision tend to make judges more reluctant to grant motions to dismiss on the ground that there's no basis in law or fact, because it's presumed that the case must be frivolous because attorney's fees must be paid. So
I think you're right. I think that on the margin, some cases that should have received motion to dismiss will not receive motion to dismiss because exactly for these reasons. But I think that the vast majority of strong cases of motion to dismiss will receive the correct judgment, and I personally see no problem either in fairness or in terms of the incentives that it provides to parties. I don't see any problem that such strong cases of successful motion to dismiss will be accompanied by a fee-shifting kind of a penalty. I think it's better than the alternatives for the reason Mr. Percy mentioned. Judges may use their discretion in a way which we think is not optimal. And here we're able to, at least for many cases, detach the decision about the case and the decision about the fee shifting. And the fee shifting happens automatically.
Okay.
I will note that this is Lee Parsley, that the bill is filed and has passed the House. That was not mandatory fee shifting. It was a may provision, and the Texas Senate then changed it to a shall provision. The judge shall shift fees if the motion to dismiss is granted. Under the kind of the concepts that we've talked about already, but also knowing there was a fair amount of discussion at the time that it might discourage judges from granting motions to dismiss in some circumstances if the judge must award those fees. But that was a balance that was in discussion here in Texas in 2011, and ultimately went from a may to a shall in the statute in order to eliminate the discretion. The judge makes a decision, does this case lack merit, and if it's subject to dismissal, then the fee shifting applies. Again, it's pretty early in this. The law came into effect September of 2011, so we're now some 9 months into it, and so we don't have a lot on the books in terms of case law about the usefulness of it, whether or empirically about whether lawyers are using it. But it is conceptually, I think, a good place to start on the concept of loser pays to see how that functions.
Were there talks back then about doing the same thing with summary judgments?
No, not at the time. This was, I think, in the in the process of the legislation, this was where I think everyone concluded was a pretty fair place to start, and we didn't really talk about summary judgment practice as well. But a fairly limited motion to dismiss award of fees to see, you know, if lawyers will use it, if clients will use it, and if it will actually function. Because, as I said, the offer of settlement process around since 2003 has not been highly functional in Texas. Lawyers just are very reticent to use it. So we're what I think I'm partly trying to emphasize is it's a somewhat experimental in Texas about how we're trying to do this and to maintain a litigation system that's not, you know, just one-sided, which no litigation system ought to be, of course.
I can't help detecting the scope of judicial power that lies even in the Texas rule on motions to dismiss, because what the court shall order is reasonable and necessary attorney's fees and costs, and the closer you get to a case that's utterly meritless, the less you would assume would be reasonable and necessary to spend. So I think judges have a very significant play in the joints, even though the language is mandatory.
Right. This is very interesting, but I think it's hard to give sympathy to lawyers who lost on motion to dismiss. I mean, you have to be really talented, so to speak, to lose on a motion to dismiss, and if you're that talented, I have no problem with you having to bear the litigation costs.
Judge, it looks like we have one more question from the audience, if you want to take it.
Then we ought to take it, by all means.
Let's do that.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. Let's consider a particular type of case, what might be called a political case, where the plaintiff is an individual and the defendant is the government, or someone well connected to government or to the courts. I see a problem because these, in many such cases, the judge is quite biased, with it effectively amplifying his ability to dismiss or to summarily judge on grounds that, from my viewpoint, would be frivolous themselves, but which favor his cronies.
I should point out that with respect to the Texas civil practice rule dealing with the dismissal of cases, it doesn't apply to suits against the government or government actors, but the other rule certainly does.
Yeah, we always need to consider not how well reforms will work if carried out by honest and competent actors, but how they will work if the actors are corrupt or incompetent. And from my experience observing judges in Texas, their level of honesty and competence is not reassuring.
I'm glad you qualified that geographically. Do we have responsive comments?
Well, this is Lee Parsley again. We do in Texas, I think both sides of the docket agree that sometimes we have unevenness in our judiciary. But in the legislative advocacy side of it, mostly we try to advocate for what we think is good public policy to be applied by honest judges. because that's really the only way you can do it, unless you you know, have clear abuse that is curable with good public policy. So that is always an issue, that the judges might not do the right thing, and I think it's not just an issue in Texas, but everywhere, and maybe we have a little more of that or less than other places, I don't know. But normally, again, we just have to focus on trying to do a policy that we think is good when applied by a good judge acting honestly and ethically, which in most circumstances is what happens, I'm convinced.
Any further comments? This concludes our hour, and this concludes our podcast. We are grateful to the panelists and for the attention and participation of the audience. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.